Tonight on Arena, in TV we review Presumed Innocent, The Boys Season 4 and House of the Dragon Season 2 and the Lebec Sisters on bringing Philip Glass's operas to two pianos. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. TV reviews to start this evening. We'll be talking about Presumed Innocent, new legal series on Apple TV based on Scott Turow's novel released in 1987, which led to the movie adaptation of the same name starring Harrison Ford and Greta Scacchi. Now, 34 laters, we have the TV drama series starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Ruth Negga. Next up, we'll don our capes to review the fourth series of The Boys. Satirical offering here, an antidote to the saturation of superhero films choosing to send up the caped creatures rather than celebrate them. Carl Urban, Anthony Starr, Jake Quaid and others, rather interestingly, begins with a highly publicised trial taking place in Manhattan. Well, how prescient was that? A defendant that resembles a certain former US president, it has to be said too. Finally, tonight, we look at the second series of Sky's fantasy drama, House of the Dragon, a prequel to Game of Thrones. Please don't turn off, don't yawn. It's based on the books of George R.R. Martin. Spin-off was created to satisfy, and there are a lot of them out there, Game of Thrones fans. Expect lots of weird character names, blonde hair, large dragons. The actors' names are straightforward enough, though, at least some of them. Matt Smith, Olivia Cooke and Rhys Evans are just some of the stars that you will see in that particular prequel. But we will start with Presumed Innocent, TV adaptation of Scott Turow's legal thriller Presumed Innocent. David E. Kelly, man with the Midas touch, is the creator, brings us a stellar cast that includes Jake Gyllenhaal, Ruth Negga and Peter Sarsgaard. 1987, I mean, this rocketed Scott Turow, the novel and the subsequent film, really rocketed him into the stratosphere in terms of book sales and in terms of, I'm sure, movie rights. Does it merit a TV treatment at this stage? It's a good old pulp fiction-y thriller, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a page-turner. And I mean, that was his debut novel. I believe he sold the rights for the movie with Harrison Ford for $1 million, which, of course, is back in like late 80s money. So I'm sure it'd be like in the tens of millions now, yeah, probably. There's a part of me that does wonder, have we run out of ideas? Do you know, is it like we have to now go back to things that were once a film or a book and like do it now? But like, there's no, you can
sure
do that.
There are a few stories, aren't there?
Yeah, like that's the thing. I mean, write what you know, I suppose. And like, I always, when these shows come along, especially on Apple, who have just like, you know, a Scrooge McDuck bank vault full of money and they get these prestige stars in, and boy are they in this one. It does make me wonder, like, is this just a cash grab? Can the actors do it justice? But this is like fun in a way. It's dark, but it's fun pulp legal thriller. It's an airport novel. The film was good. I revisited this week, the Harrison Ford one. So the show does have a bit of stuff to live up to, but a lot of people will become to this completely blind, will have no recollection of what came before. And for them, it's just, oh, it's the new Jake Gyllenhaal show. It's about a crime. It's a courtroom drama. I'll dive in.
Yeah, also the new Ruth Negga show. And there is a slightly different, I suppose, focus here in some ways, Jen, in that many people will know the film, and the film was pretty much about Greta Scacchi, that character, who was the character with whom the Jake Gyllenhaal character, who was Harrison Ford back then, they had an affair. But where we are with this one, we're with Jake Gyllenhaal, the lawyer, and Ruth Negga, the wife.
Yes,
the obviously the person with whom he had the affair is present in the cast, but in a new way.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you have somebody like Ruth Negga of her calibre, it would be churlish not to give her a role to get her teeth into. And I'm glad of this focus, and it feels like it's very much within the realms of David E. Kelly. And I think that's what makes me so comfortable about this show. You know what you're going to get with a David E. Kelly show and with Presumed Innocent itself. It's kind of like going to your favourite restaurant, and it may not be Michelin star quality. It may not be something complicated, but it's something that satisfies that need inside you, that hunger inside you. And he is so good at doing this type of TV, as in, like, his past is, you know, LA Law. It's like the practice.
And Ally that's
McBeal.
The area we're in,
he's,
really.
It's courtroom drama. Yeah. It's purely adult courtroom drama. And the Ruth Negga part is a part of that, as in, you know, her husband, who, the preposterously named Rusty Savage. Like, if there's one thing they should change about the show, it's the name. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal's not a Rusty. She's not a Barbara. Like, they're very 80s, 90s names. I found that a bit weird. Okay. But other than that, I think that's where it ends in those comparisons. I think with the Ruth Negga character, it is just about that fragility she brings to it, the vulnerability she brings to it, where you're like, you know, I've been married to this man who was my sweetheart for so long. Not only was he cheating on me, but could he have murdered someone? It's all about the stranger in her bed. And I think she does that so well. There's a scene in episode 5 where she goes to therapy, and it is a masterclass in just watching her eyes and her eyebrows and her eyes fill with tears, and what she's holding in all the time about how she's really trying to keep her family together. They have two teenage, they have a son and a daughter, and keeping this family together just for the sake of those kids. Like, but also it's also her feeling, I will feel this rage eventually against him, but I have to keep a lid on it until we know what happens. And that is what David E. Kelly is so good at. He's so good at breadcrumbing. He's so good
That I watched the first episode today, and the breadcrumbs just keep dipping along. You think, at what point are we going to find out that he had an affair? At what point is everybody going to confront him about that? Because if you know the film, and I think a lot of people will, and I'm giving nothing away to say that he becomes a suspect here.
Yes. It's a video shop staple. Like, if you were around in the 90s, you were well versed in this.
It's pretty obvious from the word go as well. Like, if you've seen a show before, you should be like, well, why was he so distraught when he got that phone call? You know, like, I wonder if there's more to this.
Yeah, so here he is. This is towards the end of episode 1, in fact. Jake Gyllenhaal as Rusty Savage. He's been questioned by his off-screen brother-in-law. I just love that fact that Peter Sarsgaard is that. He plays the character of Tommy Molto here, who's now with the new prosecuting DA. And he has a few questions for Rusty about the person and a former colleague of theirs who was found murdered.
So when was the last time you were in Carolyn's apartment?
I was at the scene following her death.
But you were gloved up, right? And your fingerprints were found in her bedroom. No one saw you enter that room. So just when was the last time you were in Carolyn's apartment prior to the murder?
We had cases together, trials. And sometimes we would work after hours, and sometimes it would be at her apartment.
So you discussed cases at her apartment?
We were work colleagues.
So I looked at Carolyn's call logs on her cell phone. You two had quite a few calls together.
What is the point of this?
The point is, I'm just trying to find out when the last time you were in Carolyn's apartment prior to the murder, and you said that you worked on cases together there.
Do I need a lawyer present at this meeting?
I think you might. That's the answer to that one, Jake. That's Jake Gyllenhaal, and for the most part, Peter Sarsgaard as Tommy Molto. But that gives you a sense. I mean, this is... Yes, there are loads of twists and turns and all the rest of it. It's good old staple diet stuff, but it's high quality. It's dressed up very nicely.
Yeah, to kind of, I guess, go on what Jen was saying about it's not a Michelin star meal, but like I think this is melodramatic junk food, which, and that's a compliment. This thing is covered in salt, you know, from the dialogue to the unbelievable cast, by the way. I mean, like, we've mentioned Jake Gyllenhaal, Ruth Negga, Peter Sarsgaard. You also have Bill Camp, the amazing Bill Camp, Renata Renzve, who was in The Worst Person in the World in 2022,
and Elizabeth Marvel.
Elizabeth Marvel,
outstanding.
Yeah, Otie Fabenley as well plays this kind of supercilious lawyer. Like, this is like, it's not elite television in terms of the construct, but the actors make it sing incredibly well. And you do get lots of those sequences where characters are boxed in. The dialogue is kind of firecracker. This is a miniseries as well. It's 8 episodes long. There won't be a season 2. Apple actually didn't give the last episode to critics, which felt like they kind of sent us out the book with the last page turned out, which really upset me. And now I have to wait 5 weeks to find out what happens.
Well, you see, welcome to the most people who are listening. Welcome to the world they have to live in.
It's a privilege to wait those 5 weeks. But no, but this was... I will say, I threw this on Saturday afternoon, and by Sunday evening I'd watched the whole thing. Yeah, apart from that last episode, of course.
Every episode ends on some kind of cliffhanger as well, so they really are keeping you watching. Yeah. And that's the thing about, as I said, David E. Kelly, and the way he works is, you know, he is there for the suspense, and he knows exactly what way to ratchet up that tension. Yeah. Like, if anybody's, you know, seen Big Little Lies recently, like, that's
all
the
of
kind
that type
of
I think
zone people, we're in for this. Like.
Absolutely. So we have the first 2 episodes can be streamed on Apple TV right now. well, not right now, but later on this evening, and the other six to follow, and the rest of us who have the previews up until episode 7 will have to wait to get episode 8, because it really is, I adore it, and I think I'll be dipping in and out of that over the coming weeks. All right, let us move on then to our second item up for review this evening, The Boys, superhero action comedy, back for a fourth series on Prime. It's a satirical reaction to the overload of superhero movies and has been quite the success for Prime. And I suppose making fun out of superhero movies is no bad thing. It really does make it makes them look as ridiculous as they sometimes do themselves without trying.
Yeah, this is based on a graphic novel series by Garth Ennis, who also did Preacher, and both the graphic novel and the subsequent TV shows of them have a penchant for extreme ultra-violence and sexual content, and it's very, very edgy. It's interesting because when The Boys came along, it definitely was a shot in the arm. We're seeing all these Marvel films in the cinema, and now here's what happens. If superheroes had powers, they wouldn't behave very nicely. They would behave terribly. Innocent bystanders would be cut down in their wake, and they would, you know, vie for power, and it would be absolute chaos, blood-soaked chaos. But now that we're on season 4 of The Boys, which, as you say, is a massive hit for Amazon, it's one of the runaway Amazon original shows, we're kind of in a situation now where it's like, well, you're now the zeitgeist. The show is now the zeitgeist, so who are you taking aim at? And the show's creator, Eric Kripke, recently said that he wasn't sure when he was going to end it, but just yesterday he said that he is sticking to his original plan to finish this after 5 seasons. So now we're kind of in that kind of setup for the final season. And I will say, as a fan of this show, I do think it's the right time to start bringing the curtain down. There's only so much you can do with this material.
All right. I wonder, could you attempt to tell us what we need to know out of seasons 1, 2, and 3 into this? There was a kind of a previously at the beginning of it today, but not having seen much of seasons 1, 2, and 3, I thought, I haven't a clue who anybody is. I'll only get to know it as episode 1 goes on.
But I think for anybody that this season in particular, season 4, so we're on the home stretch, as we were saying, it is fan service at this stage.
So this is to wrap things up.
It is, kind of. And I think the most important thing that people, if they're coming to this blank, is what Dave was saying, where it is this allegory about what it about celeb worship, really, and about what happens when you let these egotistical people run riot over the general public. And you have this figure who is Homelander, who's played by Anthony Starr, and he's like this, he is the superhero that's like Captain America, which is reflective of that kind of binary politics that we have at this moment, especially in America, where you have somebody who you seem charismatic, but underneath it all, there is a lot of dirty behaviour going on. And then you have The Boys, which are these ragtag group of heroes, if you like, for want of a better word, but they are tormented, like they're misfits, they're tormented by their own demons and they're trying to push against it. But also it kind of reflects that the internal squabbling that goes on between the left as well, where you can't actually have a clear voice, or, you know, and that's why the other side are kind of winning, is the point to The Boys, is because they have this message that may not be, you know, something that's true, but it's something that people can get behind. It's easy to swallow. And now in this season, which you said is so bizarre, because it begins with this trial in Manhattan. Homelander is on trial for murder.
Homelander, played by
Anthony Starr, and it feels very Trumpian in a way. And I don't know how they knew this was going to happen, because the thing about it was delayed for a year. It was filmed over a year ago because of the writer strike. So it is weirdly prescient. But not only is he dealing with the fact that his public mask is kind of slipping more than ever, he also has a son on board as well. And it's all about the fate of this child, whether this son will, you know, turn to the dark side, basically, or
or whether this son, who thought up to this point he was Butcher's son, didn't he? What he kind of thought.
That's the Carl Urban character.
Seasons one, two, and three.
Yeah, and he's like a quote unquote good guy, but of course he's a maniac. They're all crazy, you know, and it's all hyper violent, and it is people colliding with each other all the time. But as Jen points out, there is a lot of satire here. It is taking aim at American politics. It is taking aim at parasocial relationships, and it does so very, very well. But at a certain point, it does begin to just kind of, you know, pinball around the place, and you are kind of seeing the same thing. So that's why with this season, they very clearly introduced kind of individual traumas for each member of The Boys to deal with. They have to face demons from their past, as does Homelander, as do the bad guys.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you're spinning in motion. But if you're a fan of the show and you've enjoyed the carnage so far, every season has made a concerted effort to up the ante, and they're still doing it.
All right. Well, let's listen to a clip that features the two major rivals, Homelander, the Anthony Starr, and the Carl Urban.
I always Carl want to Urban. Say Keith Urban, but that's yeah. Nicole Kidman's husband. Yeah.
So, who plays the character of Butcher. We know that this stage that he's unwell, there's a big, I think he's got some kind of brain problem going on. But there's a little fight here between the two rivals over the son. And it's Butcher, first of all, who's explaining to the son, you know, things aren't, I'm not the bad guy that you think I am.
I know you're angry with me and you've got every right to be. But you know how dangerous Homelander is.
He's my dad.
Right, he murdered some poor sod right in front of your eyes.
That guy was a pedophile.
Right, it ain't true. He's lying to you. Let me take you to Grace, all right? And then you don't got to see me no more. Please, I'm begging you. It's what your mum would want.
No means no, William. This isn't the Neverland Ranch. Don't worry. Nothing bad's gonna happen, right? Oh, it seems it already has. Look at that big black mass curdling around your brain. What do you got, 6 months?
Less.
It's too bad. We're not going to have that last dance together. I'll miss us.
Bloody hell. You wait to your own voice, don't you?
That's a spirit champ. Son, come on. I do not want to miss Smash Mouth.
There we go. That's Carl Urban as Butcher. That Anthony Starr as Homelander, the last voice that you heard there. Carl Urban as Butcher, the first voice that you heard. And Ryan, the son, the argument that it's all about is Cameron Cravetti. I mean, they're so naughty, even within that clip. You know, no means no, this isn't the Neverland Ranch. And earlier on, you know, references to paedophilia from the young guy. And they're playing very dark style of comedy in this, but they play it so straight.
Yeah, and like the interplay between those two actors is really, really strong. Like they are, like Anthony Starr, who was on a TV show called Banshee before, this has been like a new lease of life for him, and he's becoming a huge star off the back of this, no pun intended. Carl Urban's always a solid hand. The edgelord humour stretches quite a bit as well. Like they are trying to kind of get some satire in there, like in a subtle way, but for the most part, like, I mean, did you think it just became like...
It became way too graphic for what it is, and it really is trying, because it is season four, to shock people, and we've had those shocks all along from, you know, season one onwards, and it really is trying to up the ante all the time. And it felt to me like a little bit like Sledgehammer, you know, at this stage. And I do worry, because I think satire has to be contained, and it can become bloated if it's not, you know, treated with care in that way. And I do feel like this is very, very dark. Like this season is probably the darkest yet, but you do wonder, with the reflection of society, do we need something that dark? America's going into election, you know, very, very soon. And you do wonder about where this can go.
It is accurate, though. Like
it is.
The divide that you see in this, you are seeing, like even for a show this heightened, it is grounded in a very troubling reality. But even at times, like, it can be mean-spirited to a fault. I mean, there's times when you're like, okay, an innocent bystander is going to be viciously killed now in 5, 4, 3, 2, and boom, you can set your watch by it. But some people love it for that reason. They want that escapism, even though it's horrible to look at sometimes.
Is it satire if it's reality, though? That's the thing. Like, if it's happening right now, and I felt it was a little bit, you know, over-egging it in that way, where you're like, well, you could literally turn on any news program in America now or listen to any extremist podcast and it would be pumping out the same information. So you're kind of just like, what exactly, who is this for anymore in that way? I felt... As Dave was saying at the beginning, it's kind of running out of steam. So I'm glad that they will be wrapping things up.
Yeah, so they should
wrap
it at the end of this season. Will you stick through it to the end? And stars from you on this one, Jen?
I mean, I think, you know, for what it is, yes, I think it's worthwhile. But I will say the jokes are kind of wearing a bit thin for me. So I would give it probably 3.
3, okay. And Dave?
3.5. I am sticking with it because I'm glad to hear that it is wrapping up next season. These are only 8-episode seasons. They've done a lot. A lot of money is spent as well. It looks incredible. The acting is strong, but like, it's the right call to start moving it to the end game now.
All right. So will you stick with this?
I will. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. First 3. And what did you say? 3 stars, was it? Yeah.
Yes. 3 stars. 3.5 for me, and 4 for Presumed Innocent. If we're also.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. I didn't ask you. Yeah. Both for both of you. Absolutely. Okay. So season 4, The Boys, Amazon Prime, with the first 3 episodes airing tomorrow, June 13th. And finally, then let us move on to House of the Dragon. a prequel to Game of Thrones. You know, Game of Thrones was a huge success. And we, I mean, certainly I got stuck into it when I got stuck in. I couldn't get out of it. But I'm not sure that I wanted a prequel. But what are we getting here?
We're into season two. It's a scary thing to say. Yeah, I just think with Game of Thrones, it has left zero cultural footprint in that way. It's very bizarre to me. And I feel like it's not, Game of Thrones wasn't part of the golden age of TV, as in it's not, you know, your Mad Men, The Sopranos, The Wire. It's not of that caliber. So it was something else. Maybe it was the final roar of the monoculture because it was so massive and it had such a huge worldwide audience. But I think, you know, with the really disappointing last season, I just feel that, was it necessary to have now these prequels? Is it necessary to have anything to do with that world? But also, in another way, on the flip side of that, now that it's calmed down a bit, there's something to be said for, you know, House of the Dragon having its own kind of, you know, because culture is kind of split up into so many tiny pieces, having its own stake in the world, which is not something that's going to, you know, be a massive thing. It's more of a fan built kind of show. And I think, you know, with season one, it did, people
it was a surprise
enjoyed
package.
It. Like people did enjoy
it. Surprise,
it
yeah.
But I think, you know, it is, I don't know. I think with the writing, the writer is Ryan Condal, so it's not, you know, the previous writers. It's not D.B. Weiss or David Benioff. They've moved on to different things. I think they were dying to move on to different things. So I just think he's tried to coax some new viewers into this. And I think, you know, season one, it was needlessly convoluted. It had a lot of time jumps and it had all these characters. This is what I loathe about, you know, Game of Thrones as a setup, and I loathe about House of the Dragon, is all these characters have exactly the same name or similar names. And like, it's season two now and nothing is ever expanded on.
Yeah.
And if you're not versed in the ways of this world, good luck, because there's, you know, is it Alicent? Is it Alice? Is it Eric, or is it Eric? They're both twins and their names are both Eric. Like, how are you supposed to follow this? Like, and the references to those multiple characters, it's so easy.
Yeah, and I mean, for the most part, we have sincere, loyal, honest people and Machiavellian, creepy,
intrigue,
evil
Shakespearean
people.
Yeah,
you know. But there's not a lot of nuance in the characterizations.
But I think what happens is, like, viewers really cared about the fortunes of someone like, you know, Ned Stark, like in Game of Thrones, and on all of that, because they had this richness to them, because perhaps they didn't expect it to be such a success and they didn't know they were going to have the massive budget or the massive audience. And they depended on the characters. Now they are dependent on the effects, it would seem to me, rather than the characterization.
Yeah, Dragons. I know you haven't seen this, Dave, but I suppose the idea of a prequel to Game of Thrones, is it purely financial? Was there a need for it?
Well, I mean,
the books are there.
It should be said, first of all, that like we both been hit with so many kind of spoiler warnings that you can't really say a lot about the new season anyway, truthfully. But I mean, like, this House of the Dragon was a surprise package because everyone was so down, myself included, on Game of Thrones. Even though I do think you're both being a little bit harsh on Game of Thrones, which I never thought I would say. For four seasons, that was an amazing
show. No, I got totally sucked into it.
It began to decline. The last season is dreadful. It has one of the worst endings of all time. I agree with Jen. It could have been Golden Age TV, but it failed. And so coming into this, there was kind of like, okay, well, who's really going to show up for this? But people did. Critics did. Fans did. The first season, I would agree, is convoluted, but it's not bad from what I've seen. And with this now, in terms of like, it wasn't a guaranteed financial hit. If anything, you know, HBO and others have been kind of dropping IP as long as they go. This has done well, and it seems to be like, the question is, does it have sticking power? Please don't go for eight seasons. Please wrap it up at four. This seems to be what you're good at, guys.
What I'm going to say is the first four episodes, very slow moving, and as in it's scene setting to the war of the second half. But I will say Emma Darcy is a talent and they do deserve something that is you know, equal to their talent. And I like the idea of Emma Darcy's character and Olivia Cooke's character being these best friends that have turned into mortal enemies. That's exciting and that's interesting that will fuel the story, but it takes a long time to get to those points.
I suppose sometimes I think now with streamers, it's how they give them to us tells us how, what they feel about them. We get all eight episodes in the one go of House of the Dragon season two on Sky Atlantic and Now from Monday, June the 17th, where whereas the others will be drip-fed to us to keep us interested. The Boys Season 4 on Amazon Prime from tomorrow, June the 13th. First three episodes, Presumed Innocent. First two episodes available now on Apple TV. And Jen Gannon and Dave Hanratty are two reviewers this evening. The next guests have been called the best piano duo in front of an audience today. They are the sisters Katia and Marielle Labeck, who will be at the National Concert Hall on Saturday to present their recent collaborations with American minimalist composer Philip Glass and arrangements for two pianos of his Cocteau trilogy. Delighted to be joined on the line right now by Katia and Marielle. You're both very welcome to the programme, Katia and Marielle, but... Philip Glass is quite a fan of yours, referring to you as being tremendous, which is a great adjective to use. I believe it was as far back as Einstein on the Beach. That was your first kind of moment of real awakening, Katia, to the music of Philip Glass.
Yes, that was, but I never met him at this time. I heard his music and I loved it, but I never met him. And it's only when he wrote for us a concerto for two piano and orchestra that we met him in Los Angeles in 2015. And since this moment, we've been very close and we've been always in contact with Philip.
Yes, it certainly seems as if the collaboration and the interaction between the three of you has been quite enormous for all of you. And Marielle, I mean, the minimalist music of Philip Glass, you weren't avoiding it, I'm sure. Was it just that other types of music were occupying you in that period in your careers?
Yeah, it is very true. I mean, there's always a moment for each kind of music, you know. And at this period, we were also playing a lot of contemporary music. And I cannot say that working with, you know, Luciano Berio, Pierre Boulez, they were not really big fan of this kind of music. Mm. But we discovered later, and especially because we did a beautiful project in London with a big project on minimalist music, and I didn't even know if I was going to do it. And Katia said, you know, just try, we're going to read, we received so much music. And finally, I thought the project was very interesting. I discovered so many composers like William Duckworth, and I don't know, it was really, really fabulous. And we enter, of course, on the music of Philip Glass, because I really like him very much, and I like everything he does. And when we play the four movements for two piano, it is such a great piece, so well written. So after that, it is true, we start and we got the first, you know, from the trilogy, we got Les Enfants Terribles during the COVID, you know, during this period. And that was a really amazing gift from Philip, okay, because we started immediately working on it. It was his idea, I have to say, because when we met him in Los Angeles himself, he said, you should play that. And of course, it was related to Jean Cocteau and all that.
Yes.
So we started with Les Enfants Terribles, and then we continued with Orphée. And yeah, it was a very beautiful project and great to be close to Philippe.
In terms of Les Enfants Terribles, which is, I suppose, it's a very important part of French culture, in that it was the Cocteau novel, it was the subsequent film. I'll address this to both of you, and well, let me address it to you, Katia, and if you want to pass it to Marielle, you can. Was that an important part of your cultural life, both the book and the film?
Yes, definitely. Cocteau was always such an amazing artist. He was a writer, a sculptor, a painter. He was doing theater. He was doing so many things. For all those reasons, he was not always considered as such a profound artist in France. Mm. And that's too bad, because he's such an amazing and unique artist, and his film were amazing. So the first time I saw La Belle et la Bête and Orphée, those two films, I think, impressed me forever. I mean, that was so amazing when you think that La Belle et la Bête was done in 1946, so no digital effect, no nothing.
Yes.
And he recreated totally such an atmosphée, and Orphée the same thing. I mean, with a lot of idea, because of course he goes really far away from the myth of Orphée, and he invented his own Orphée,
with a gothic princess all dressed in black with black hair, and Maria Cazares, she was sublime, really. So that, yeah, was an important moment of our life.
Well, let's have a listen to the piano version then, if you like, of The Cocoon of Shawls. This is from Les Enfants Terribles, and this is a recording that both yourself, Katia, and Marielle made. Just the opening section of The Cocoon of Shawls, the piano duo version of a suite drawn from the operatic music of Philip Glass, based on the Cocteau film Les Enfants Terribles. Katia and Marielle Lebec with me on the programme this evening. They'll be playing the Cocteau trilogy in its entirety in the National Concert Hall this coming Saturday evening. It strikes me as I'm listening to that, Marielle, yes, there are quite definitely, you know, those minimalist figures of Glass in there, the repeated phrases, that type of thing, and the slight semitonal shifts that go along, that carry us along with them. But it's much more textured, I feel, maybe it's just because it's two pianos, but it's much more textured than than we might think of when we hear the word minimalist music.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, just speaking about Philip does not like when we play everything so even and mechanic. He really doesn't like that at all. I think what was interesting in this work with Orphée, La Belle et la Bête and Les Enfants Terribles is that the character is completely different. So it might be repetitive music, but it is completely different because La Belle et la Bête is much more romantic. And Orphée is... again, a different, you know, kind of music. And then Les Enfants Terribles is much more dramatic in D minor. And so it is very beautiful to go through all those pieces. It's really like a trip, you know, with many things. And the sound has to be, the texture has to be different. I mean, we really worked on that. But if you just do that rhythmically and even, it can be really extremely boring, which is not. And he has written very, very beautiful melody, which sounds really like Schubert. So it's really, he goes further than just repetitive music or minimalist. I don't know what it means, but for me, it is not.
Yeah, I suppose in some ways, Katja, we often hear the same type of thing said about Bach and keyboard music. Oh, it's music for a sewing machine, or, you know, it's very mechanical, it's very mathematical. But it's finding the expression within that I guess is the real challenge. And I believe Philip Glass is very keen that the performer takes it on board rather than be a slave to notes on a page.
Yeah, I think the relationship with dynamic, with sound, and also with style is very important. And speaking about Bach, I mean, in the world of Baroque music, it's never mechanic.
Yes.
Maybe, yes, with Glenn Gould, yes. And of course, he was a fabulous pianist and he had a huge influence. But his Bach are very mechanic, for sure. And that was like that he wanted to play it. But if you hear with other people like Giovanni Antonini with Giardino Armonico or the Baroque group, it sounds totally, totally different. So I don't know. I think for Glass, he refers every time about which story you are saying, you know, with, if you say the story of Orphée, it's not like the same than La Belle et la Bête or Les Enfants Terribles. What Marielle was saying, that at the end, Orphée and La Belle et la Bête ends quite good in Cocteau, because it's not the traditional Orphée. Les Enfants Terribles ends dramatically with the death of Paul and Elizabeth. So it's totally different.
Yeah. Yes, let's have a listen to some of La Métamorphose from, and this is from La Belle et la Bête. And, you know, to my ear here, we could almost be in the world of French Impressionism. Let's have a listen.
Totally.
There we have it, the opening section of La Métamorphose, the suite of piano music drawn from La Belle et la Bête, a Philip Glass opera based on the Cocteau film of the same name, and played there by Katia and Marielle Lebec, who are with me on the programme this evening. And as I said going into that, I mean, I would hazard a guess, if you played that piece of music for somebody and you give them three choices, one of which was Ravel, one of which was Debussy, and one of which was Philip Glass, the last person you would think of just hearing that out of context, Marielle, perhaps would be Philip Glass. It really is that kind of lush impressionism of Debussy or Ravel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, all the musicals, Philippe is like that. I can really hear Debussy. I can hear Ravel. I can hear Schubert, definitely, especially dans La Belle et la Bête. And yeah, it is what we like with this music. I don't find it repetitive or minimalist.
Not at all. And certainly on the basis of that. And Katia, what Glass did with La Belle et la Bête is very interesting, because he took the Cocteau film, took the soundtrack off it, if you like. He took the dialogue off it, and then composed an opera on top of that.
Yeah, I know. That was crazy. A crazy idea. Maybe not the easiest for the interpreters, because everything was about the clique, which at the end, that's exactly what we have tried to forget, you know, and to be totally free in this piece. Because as Marielle was saying before, La Belle et la Bête refers really to romantic music. I mean, even Chopin, you know, Schubert, Brahms, I think the idea of Philippe was very interesting. But musically, if you have to do everything with a click, it's like a nightmare. I would not be able to play like that. But they've done an amazing thing with that. But it's also good when we have this opportunity to take a piece from where we know it to somewhere else, you know. And that was the case with this trilogy, because we got the possibility to take it from an opera with singer, with orchestra, and just to piano. And actually, you don't miss the singer, you don't miss the orchestra, because all the melody are there, all the rhythm is there, all the drama is there. And of course, we are also very helped on stage, because we have this amazing chandelier, and with those really great light, and that's very rare, because it's not like a concert, a normal recital concert, but it is something special. It's not theater either, because, you know, we are not Cyril Test has done the scenography with Nina Shallow, but it's not really, we are not acting, so it's not a play, but it's a new way of presenting
it.
Yes,
to present
also
music.
Nice to enter in the darkness, and we hear the voice of Jean Cocteau, which are very important and very beautiful lines, and we enter like that quietly, and then the voice stops, and then the music starts, and this lighting, which is magical above the piano. So it's very important, I think, for this kind of music to try to recreate what we saw with this movie, La Belle et la Bête, which really made me dream again and cry, you know, recently, because I wanted to see it again. It's beautiful.
We
need something a little bit special.
Yeah,
when
to
we
give
play
it that fairy tale aspect.
Exactly.
And I guess I wondered, Marielle, for the two of you, I mean, obviously yourself and Katya have played piano and have played piano duet for such a long time together, and your sisters. So there's a kind of a communication that maybe is so automatic and is so entrenched in what you do at this stage that it's wonderful. But for the music of Philip Glass, is there a different type of communication? Because it strikes me at times there are all sorts of cross rhythms going on, and one of you could be playing in one time signature, the other in another. I know that happens in other pieces as well. But did Glass present a particular challenge in that respect?
No, the interesting thing. Okay. Marielle,
yeah, you go on. You go on.
Okay. What I was saying is that the interesting thing in Philip, in this trilogy, is always about duality. It's always about two people. It's La Belle et la Bête. It's Orphée and the Princess. It's Paul and Elizabeth. And of course, it's also Marielle and I. I mean, it's all, you have always those two voices answering to each other, you know. And of course, we relate very easy to that. That's something, but with a lot of work, of course, with a lot of rehearsal, because without this amount of rehearsal, you cannot feel free, you know, to improvise on the tempi, on the sound, on everything. So that's really the base of everything is that. And then your imagination.
Yeah. Did you want to add anything to that, Mariella? Because I want to finish up with
it. It is true, because I think the most difficult when we are playing together is just to try to reach a kind of freedom, because we don't have so much freedom with two pianos. And sometimes, you know, when I hear a piano duet, it can be very mechanical because they are scared not to play together or whatever. But after so many years, also like Ravel, you know, when we play Jardin Féerique or Ma Mère Loire, it is very hard for the same reason. There is very little note, and then we need to feel each other really, because we work a lot, and then we try to forget the work we've done and to feel a kind of freedom. And it's the same with Philippe. And now more we play it and more we are inside the music, and we can move enjoy together.
Yeah. Well, I'm going,
and not just keep the same tempo, which is very boring.
Well, exactly. And I'll finish up with listen to a little bit of La Chambre d'Orphée, so that we've represented all three operas and all three pieces in the trilogy and in the concert that you'll be performing on Saturday evening. This one's all about, I know in the stage production, it's all about mirrors and pieces of glass and reflecting across at each other. So I suppose it is it's a perfect representation of the two of you in that respect as well. Katya and Marielle Lebec, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So
we're very happy to be back in Dublin.
Yes, and looking forward to seeing you.
Yes, we love this
very
city.
Happy. Yeah, we love the city very much.
Okay, let's finish up then with that little bit of La Chambre d'Orphée from the Philip Glass music. For the naysayers who think that minimalism is all lacking in lyricism, that is La Chambre d'Orphée from the trilogy, the Cocteau trilogy, rearrangements of the operatic music of Philip Glass for two pianos, played by Marielle and Katya Lebec. And they will be at the National Concert Hall this coming Saturday, the 15th of June, playing all three piano duets, the Orpheus, the Les Enfants Terribles, and La Belle et la Bête. NCH.ie for full details. Described as the time traveller's wife having an affair with a gentleman in Moscow, Kellyanne Bradley's The Ministry of Time, genre-bending novel that blends science fiction and the spy novel and more than a dash of romance. Declan Burke has been reading The Ministry of Time for us and he joins me now. I was saying just during the ad break there, Declan, when I read The Ministry of Time as the title, I thought, oh, this is straight out of Orwell.
Yeah, and I would imagine that's deliberately intended. No, it's not Orwell. We are in the very near future, in fact, and The Ministry of Time is the very latest branch of the British Secret Service. We discover late in the novel, we won't say too much about it, how the British Secret Service and got its hands on a time machine. But what they're doing is they're going back in time to exfiltrate, or expatriate, I should say, people who were on the verge of death or just or dying of illness or whatever, and bringing them forward into our present. Now, that's a very noble and charitable thing to do, you might think, which is not what the British Secret Service are generally known for.
Yeah, and also you're messing with history there, and potentially are you changing the future and the prime directive, as we all
the
know?
The prime directive, well, the idea
is we can't do that.
If they're about to die, that means they can't impact on their present. Anyway, it's all very complicated, but it's successful.
So we're kind of brought through the novel by a 21st century civil servant, a young woman who has been given a job in this Ministry of Time and is quite delighted with herself at the new job.
She is, and we're never told what her name is. She's British Cambodian, by the way. She's a civil servant, and Kellyanne Bradley herself is British Cambodian. She's given the title of a bridge because she is the bridge between the expatriate who comes from the past and the present that he finds himself living in. And that expatriate, the other main character, Commander Graham Gore, who in 1847 disappeared from the Franklin expedition to find the Northwest Passage, mysteriously presumed dead, but in fact he's been brought forward into the present.
In fact,
Commander Gore is an actual historical figure. Kellyanne Bradley has plucked him from the history books, just as the Ministry of Time did in the novel. And they make for a very unusual pairing. And you mentioned romance in the intro, and that's an important part of the novel.
Yeah, because there's certainly a frisson between the two of them. But I guess part of the fun of the novel in many ways is you pluck somebody from 1840s, and you bang them into 2022, 23, 24, whatever particular year Kellyanne Bradley has given us here. And obviously, things have changed just a little.
Quite a lot. The British Empire is nowhere as dominant as it used to be. He's very disappointed about that. And of course, the technology, he's completely all at sea, but quickly gets, he's a smart man, he's an intelligent man, quickly gets to grips with the likes of Facebook and Spotify. He's a big fan of Spotify and so forth. But what's more interesting is, once you kind of get beyond the surface level stuff, is both the narrator, who is a kind of an outsider being British Cambodian, and Commander Gore, who's come from the past, they both have a kind of an off-kilter, jaundiced take on contemporary Britain. And the more that our bridge has to explain to Commander Gore about the various absurdities and strangeness, etc., the less they make sense to her. So it's a very clever thing that Kellyanne Bradley has done.
Touch of a State of the Nation novel.
Very much so.
And the other aspect I thought about, you mentioned Kellyanne Bradley's British Columbian ethnicity.
Cambodian,
I beg your pardon. And similarly, with the unnamed narrator here, the fact that you do take somebody from the 19th century, when the British Empire was at its height, when colonialism was in full swing, is there a lot of commentary in and around that aspect of things?
There's very much from the narrator's point of view, because the novel itself is fascinated with the idea of history. And we would think it's Commander Gore who is at the centre of that, because he is history. He's come from history. But in fact, it's the narrator, who has her mother experienced the horrors under the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the 1970s. And she has had to live with the baggage and the consequences of that all her life, not least because everybody else seems to have their assumptions of what her history must be. So there are very interesting questions being asked the whole time about what history is. In fact, her boss at the Ministry of Time tells her, "You misunderstand how history works. History is not a series of causes and effects which may be changed like switching trains. It's a narrative agreement about what has happened and what is happening." And this is kind of the underpinning thesis that runs straight through the novel.
So we have the 21st century civil servant. We have Gore from the 19th century. Are there other both bridges and expatriates from various points in history.
There is
too.
A whole family, a wider family of expats, and there's a lot of comedy that's derived from that because they can come from the medieval period. And sometimes there's a bit of tragedy as well because one man has been plucked from the trenches of 1916. So there's a wider community that Commander Gore, this is what helps him to kind of assimilate in contemporary Britain. And they all kind of have their own subplots and sub-stories and so forth.
It struck me that it has the real feel of something that would make a television series, you know, that you could constantly have these people plucked from the past and brought into a current situation. Does it have that feel of it, or is this very much a standalone book?
It definitely could be opened out. It reminded me of that TV programme, I think it was in the 1980s, was it called Quantum Leap?
Yes,
to that effect. So, yes, there's potentially a never-ending series of expatriates being brought forward from the past. The book is self-contained, there's no doubt about it. I'm not sure if there's even a sequel possible without giving away too much. instead of a TV series, what this is the perfect beach read. We're coming into summer.
I was going to ask you how much is this a novel of ideas, or is it just a good old entertaining read?
And this is the clever thing about it. It's both. On the surface, it's a romance, it's sci-fi, it's a spy thriller and so forth. Underneath, Callie-Anne Bradley has a lot of interesting questions to ask about contemporary Britain, about what a history is and how we perceive our immediate history and how that impacts who we are going forward.
How acerbic is it on its view of contemporary Britain?
Well, it's a very interesting tone because you're right to use the word acerbic because the narrator and Commander Gore, they're both outsiders looking in. Mm. So they're both, as I say, I've used the phrase, a jaundiced eye on society. But at the same time, the narrator has spent her whole life trying to fit in. So she's almost conditioned not to complain too much, not to criticise her adopted homeland too much. So it's a kind of a high wire act that the narrator has been obliged to follow her entire life, and that's the kind of high wire act that Callie-Anne Bradley has used for.
And Callie-Anne Bradley has previously written short stories. This is a debut novel. On the basis of it, it's a recommendation, and you want more.
Oh, I think it's terrific. It does sci-fi, it does romance, it does history, it does. Spy thriller. I'm not sure what it doesn't do, Sean. No, it's a terrific read. Hugely, gorgeously readable book.
A gorgeously readable book, The Ministry of Time by Callie-Anne Bradley, which is published by Sceptre. Now, earlier I asked you about Gary Lydon, who's appearing in A Handful of Stars at the Pavilion Theatre in Dalry. I wanted to know what Oscar-nominated film shot in Achill County Mayo did he play the character of Garth Pathakarni? The Banshees of Inisherin played, and he was in that, of course, and winning the competition, tickets to the show and the overnight stay at the Royal Marine Hotel is Jen Tipper. Congratulations to you, Jen. Enjoy your evening and your overnight stay in Dunleary. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Barbara Rose Sanwell researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.